Welcome to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. We aim to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring the listener a broad range of topics and expertise. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I'm the Gila Grassroots Organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the protection, restoration, and continued enjoyment of New Mexico's wildlands and wilderness areas. On today's show, we'll be talking with Judy Kalman, staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance based in Albuquerque. Welcome to Earth Matters, Judy.
Thanks, Nathan.
It's nice to have you on. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I guess you moved to New Mexico in, 2001, and you have a lifelong passion for the West.
I did. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and had always sort of been obsessed with going to New Mexico, and I don't really know where it came from, but it lasted until I went to college, and I started at the University of Maryland and didn't like it very much, and so I actually did an exchange program out here when I was 19 and intended to stay for one semester, but as New Mexico usually goes, that was 12 and a half years ago,
right.
And I've never left.
It's a good kind of land of entrapment, right?
It totally is a good kind. I can't imagine living anywhere else anymore.
Well, so for the past 3 years, you've been helping the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance ensure that federal agencies are complying with a host of environmental laws, working to propose more federal lands for administrative protections, and, of course, appealing agency actions, which are particularly damaging to public lands. Today, we're going to talk, hopefully, for about half the segment of the show, half of it, we'll be talking about the McKittrick policy. Can you give us a little brief background on what the McKittrick policy is and why it is a terrible thing?
Sure. So it's really interesting because all through law school and other graduate school and other work on environmental issues, I had actually never heard of the McKittrick policy. And it's sort of been this hidden, awful thing that hadn't really been talked about. And the way that I found out about it was actually just because of random curiosity. I had heard about wolves getting shot in the Gila, and New Mexico Wilderness Alliance had been working on wolves a little bit when I first got here. And so about a year and a half ago, it occurred to me that, you know, we keep hearing about wolves getting shot or found dead, and we didn't really hear anything about anybody going to jail.
Right, nothing was happening.
Right, and so it was just sort of something I noticed in the news that, you know, the deaths would get reported, but the follow-up never did. And I knew that the Endangered Species Act came with federal criminal penalties, and the penalties are up to a year in jail and a $50,000 fine for endangered species that are harmed or killed, and half of those penalties, so $25,000 and 6 months in jail for threatened species. And the wolves are, their penalties are like threatened species because they're an experimental population in New Mexico, but
right. They
still come with federal jail time and a pretty large fine. And so I was just sort of curious about why we never heard about those fines being put on people. And so I started looking into it, and after a long series of Freedom of Information requests and talks with the Fish and Wildlife Service, I came across what's called the McKittrick policy. And what the McKittrick policy is a Department of Justice policy, and the Department of Justice is required to prosecute federal crimes. It's not the Fish and Wildlife Service that would actually do the prosecutions. It's the Department of Justice. And in 1998, they developed a policy called the McKittrick policy, which was named after a case that was argued in federal court. And the policy basically states that they internally decided that they would not prosecute anybody for endangered species violations unless they could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person knew exactly what biological species they were harming at the time that they harmed it. And so this is really interesting because it's not what the statute says. The Endangered Species Act doesn't require knowledge of the individual species in order to be assessed with a penalty. It just requires that the person harmed an endangered species that turned out to be endangered, because the ultimate goal of the act is recovery of endangered species.
So how did the McKittrick policy even become to exist? You said it started in 1998. That's right around the same exact time when the Mexican Gray Wolf Program was beginning.
Yeah, it was a weird coincidence of time, but the McKittrick policy happened about 6 months after the reintroduction of Mexican wolves in the Gila. The McKittrick policy is a national policy, so it doesn't just apply to the wolves. It applies to all endangered species everywhere. So the timing was coincidental, but oddly, the actual McKittrick case for which the policy was named was a gray wolf case that happened in Montana. And the policy came about because of a series of federal cases. So a guy named Chad McKittrick in 1998 shot and killed a gray wolf in Montana, which was at the time an endangered species, not a threatened species. And he was prosecuted by the Justice Department and convicted, and he was going to go to jail and pay a large fine. And he appealed his conviction to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which upheld his conviction and said, sorry, you don't actually have to show that you knew what species you were shooting. It just matters that you harmed a gray wolf. And so he was preparing to take his appeal all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and appeal the Ninth Circuit's confirmation of his conviction. And as they were getting ready to go to the Supreme Court with this case, the Department of Justice Solicitor's Office wrote a brief to the Supreme Court saying, never mind, we're not going to prosecute cases this way anymore.
So DOJ got in the middle of it and stopped it from going to the Supreme Court.
Well, he was preparing to ask the Supreme Court to take his case, but the other side of this case was always Department of Justice because they had prosecuted him in the first place, but they were the other party that he was appealing. And so they were a party anyway, so he filed a brief to the Supreme Court asking them to hear his case and to overturn it on the basis that he didn't know what species he was shooting. And in their reply brief, where they responded to his brief, they said, we're not going to use this as a reason to prosecute people anymore. And so it was just kind of an internal brief in preparation for a court case, and the Supreme Court declined to hear the case because at that point, it wasn't really an issue anymore. And then right after the Supreme Court declined to hear the case, the Department of Justice issued a memo to all U.S. attorneys saying, don't prosecute people anymore if you can't prove that the person knew what they were shooting at the time they shot it. So the fallout of this has been, and it was predictable from the beginning, that people's ability to determine which species are endangered and which are not has declined sharply since 1998. So all of a sudden, no one can tell what is a wolf and what is a coyote and what is a dog.
Or what's the difference between a grizzly bear and a black bear?
Right. So all of a sudden, all anybody has to do when they accidentally or on purpose shoot or harm an endangered species is say that they thought it was some other species that's not protected. And they know that they won't get prosecuted. And this has shown up on sportsmen's websites, on hunting websites, on anti-wolf websites, on all kinds of things. So people are using this policy very purposely to harm endangered species. And through the Freedom of Information Act requests and research that we've done, we found cases from all over the country of grizzly bears getting shot and people saying, oh, I thought it was a black bear. And
you, seriously, you can't tell the difference between a gigantic grizzly bear and a small black bear?
Right.
It's absurd.
So, and there's cases of people lying to Fish and Wildlife law enforcement and hiding evidence and destroying radio collars and burying things on property and burying things on public land, and none of it matters because all they have to do is say they thought it was something else. And occasionally they get fined for smaller things, but hardly anybody ever gets prosecuted for actual Endangered Species Act violations anymore.
Yeah, on that point, Judy, if you don't mind me interrupting, how many people have actually been prosecuted in New Mexico for the illegal killings of Mexican gray wolves? Is there anybody?
In New Mexico and Arizona combined, which is the whole recovery area for Mexican wolves, in the last 15 years, two people have been prosecuted.
Two people?
But
and how many wolves have been?
There have been 50 wolves that have been shot and deemed illegally killed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so of those, you know, they can't always find out who did it.
Right.
But there are a lot of cases where they have, and there are investigative files, and they do know who did it, and people admit to doing it, but they just say, oh, I thought it was a dog, or, oh, I thought it was a coyote. And it happens with extraordinary regularity. We found, even just this year, a guy in Texas was in a wildlife refuge and had a hunting permit for a sandhill crane. I don't know why people hunt sandhill cranes, but he shot and killed a juvenile whooping crane instead. Uh-oh. And it was one of 34 juvenile whooping cranes in the entire country. And he said, thought it was a sandhill crane and didn't get prosecuted. And so it kind of, this policy takes away the responsibility of hunters and other people from knowing what they're shooting before they shoot it, from identifying species correctly, and it's been really amazingly damaging to all kinds of species.
Well, this must be really frustrating for the Fish and Wildlife Service, I would imagine. I can't see them happy with
the Fish and Wildlife Service does not seem particularly supportive of the McKittrick policy, although I think I'm not sure that they would say that out loud, but they probably would. It's very inhibiting of their ability to go out and do investigations, and it's inhibiting of their whole recovery effort for all kinds of endangered species.
So the Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't even said anything publicly about the McKittrick policy, is that correct?
No, they have. I guess I feel sort of protective of them, but there have been a couple of Fish and Wildlife memos arguing that the policy should be rescinded, and actually one of the DOI Interior Secretaries in the last 15 years tried to get the Justice Department to rescind the policy, if I'm remembering correctly, and the Justice Department didn't do it. So there has been some talk about it. It's just been really interesting because it's not a very well-known policy among environmental groups or among the general public, but it seems to be very well-known inside Fish and Wildlife and among anti-endangered species communities. So one thing we definitely wanted to do was get the word out that this policy even exists.
Right.
And I was shocked.
Well, I'm shocked too. I mean, when I first found out about this, I couldn't believe it. We're going to be going to a break here in about a minute, and I want to thank you for that nice overview of the McKittrick policy. Now, if you can, just briefly, tell us what we're doing about it.
Well, the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and Wildlife Guardians decided to file a lawsuit against Department of Justice in order to try to get this policy revoked. So that's one thing that we're doing. I'm exploring a couple other options about talking to the Fish and Wildlife about some things it could do to protect wolves specifically from this policy, which I can talk about when we get back. And then also just, you know, getting people to be aware of it.
We are talking with Judy Kalman, the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. I'm your host, Nathan Newcomer, with Earth Matters. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to the Gila Memories Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm Nathan Newcomer, the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. And with us today, we have Judy Kalman, the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance up in Albuquerque. And in our first segment, we talked about the McKittrick policy, which is a Department of Justice policy that essentially says that anybody that's found guilty of shooting or killing in an endangered species or a threatened endangered species, if they didn't know what species they were shooting at, can actually get off the hook and they're not prosecuted. So, Judy, in our last segment, you told us that the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and Wild Earth Guardians have filed a lawsuit against the Department of Justice on the McKittrick policy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. And can I clarify something you just said, too?
Please do correct me.
You said that even if they were found guilty, this policy means that they wouldn't even be found guilty.
Ah.
It means that no charges would be brought against the person at all.
Very important
point. Even when there was evidence that they did shoot one. So it means that no criminal charges would even be brought against the person. That's what this policy means.
Gotcha. Thank you for...
Unless the person said, I knew I was shooting a gray wolf or a Mexican wolf and I shot it anyway. I mean, like, if you get somebody who says that, they could be prosecuted.
But
or,
I doubt,
you know,
yeah,
if it's a
no
person
one's
with
that.
A biology degree in Mexican wolf, then you can pretty much prove that they knew what they were shooting. But it's a really interesting thing, and you know, like, even the Fish and Wildlife Service goes out of its way to teach people who are going into the Gila about the differences between Mexican wolves and coyotes, and gives out pamphlets that tell the difference and stuff like that. And so they try very hard to get people to recognize when something is a Mexican, something is a coyote, and even so, if people say they didn't know, they won't be prosecuted. So ridiculous.
So yeah, tell us a little bit more about this lawsuit.
So after reviewing all the things that happened, and like I said, we submitted a bunch of Freedom of Information Act requests, which gave us the files of both Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement and some internal files from Department of Justice. We decided, along with Wild Earth Guardians, that there was enough there that we should actually bring a lawsuit against the Department of Justice to get that policy overturned, because it's actually never been challenged in court. I don't know whether that's because people just didn't know about it or whether the timing wasn't right or whatever, but no one's ever actually brought it in front of a judge as the policy to try to get it overturned. So we filed our initial lawsuit in May of this year, and we alleged a couple different things. One is that the Department of Justice potentially violated the Endangered Species Act by not consulting with Fish and Wildlife when it made the policy. Federal agencies are required under the EESA, which is the act, to consult with Fish and Wildlife whenever they do anything that might jeopardize an endangered species. So one of the things we're saying is that the Department of Justice issuing this policy was something that could have potentially jeopardized the species, and we think that's true because it's not enforcing the penalties in the act, and they didn't consult with Fish and Wildlife before they issued the policy. So that's one thing that we said was a problem. We also said that there was a problem doing a policy without consulting the public. That's something that agencies are required to do whenever they do formal rulemaking. And so we're arguing that because this policy applies all over the country to all attorneys in the Department of Justice, the formal rulemaking that they did and made without consulting the public. So those are kind of our two biggest issues. We are expecting the Department of Justice's response. We were expecting it October 23rd, but that's now sort of on hold because of the shutdown. All the deadlines seem to have been postponed a little bit.
Right.
So sometime in the next month or so, DOJ will have to file a response, and then we'll have a hearing. So we're pretty excited, and we feel pretty good about it. But, you know, it's a pretty big deal to sue the Justice Department. So.
Yeah,
that's,
I think that's a first for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, taking on DOJ.
It is a definite first for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance.
That's pretty exciting.
And a definite first for me as well.
Well, so those two issues that you brought up, is there anything else in the lawsuit that is of pertinence?
Those are the two biggest issues. We had a couple other little things, but we were able to find a lot of documents that indicated both from the Interior Department and from even state game officials in Arizona and New Mexico that indicated that the McKittrick policy was having a very negative impact, Endangered Species Act recovery. We focused our lawsuit on wolves, although we did mention some other species and the fact that it was a nationwide policy. But we filed it in Arizona, actually, because the recovery area goes between Arizona and New Mexico. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. We're very hopeful about it.
Was there anything else that you'd like our listeners to know about the McKittrick policy? Is there anything that they can do at this point, or is it just sort of a waiting game with the court system?
It's mostly a waiting game, but public pressure on elected officials is always great. You know, the Department of Justice is an administrative agency, so it's under the executive branch, which means that the president appoints the head of DOJ. which is Eric Holder at the moment. So, you know, letters to Barack Obama always help. Letters to Eric Holder always help. Even letters to elected officials help. Anything that could help, you know, draw attention to this policy being in place and the need to get it overturned would be helpful. I mean, we don't have to overturn it in a lawsuit. DOJ could make an internal decision to get rid of the policy because it's harmful to endangered species recovery. So any kind of pressure like that is always good. From the public.
Something that's popped in my mind, is there anything that the state attorney can do, the New Mexico state attorney?
I don't think so, at least not in New Mexico. the Martinez administration made a decision a couple of years ago to pull out of the wolf recovery program.
Right.
So our state game and fish department is not really involved with the wolf program anymore, which I'm not sure other people know either. So, you know, our state attorney general could come out with this statement saying he opposes the policy. I'm just not sure that that's any more help public saying it.
We are talking with Judy Kalman, the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. So, Judy, there's obviously a host of other issues that you work on being the attorney for our organization. One of the big things that was on your plate recently was the draft resource management plan for Doniana, Otero, and Sierra counties. In particular, that covers quite a broad swath of land that we're concerned about in Doniana County with the Oregon Mountains, as well as, you know, a place that's near and dear to my heart, the Otero Mesa. Can you tell us a little bit about the draft RMP and what's good, what's bad, and what people can do?
Sure. Well, for people who don't know, a resource management plan is a large land use planning packet of information, basically.
Packet.
That each Bureau of Land Management, a giant plan. So the Bureau of Land Management in each state is divided up into smaller field offices, and those field offices prepare these management plans every 20 years to govern all of their land use planning decisions for the land under their jurisdiction. So it only applies to BLM land in those three counties, and that's part of the Las Cruces office of the Bureau of Land Management. And the Las Cruces office actually manages six counties, but because that's so large, they're doing resource management plans in two pieces. So this particular one is for the three counties that you mentioned, and then in a couple of years, whenever they finish this one, they'll start the revision of the other plan, which would cover Grant, Hidalgo, and Luna counties.
The Membres Valley.
So, yes, the Membres Resource Plan, which actually might even be more exciting because it covers the Gila Lower Box and some areas in the Bootheel. So both of them are kind of exciting plans. But it's really important for us to be involved at this level because it's kind of like a bird's eye view plan for what the BLM is going to use its land for a pretty long time. So in general, resource management plans make decisions like where oil and gas can be leased, where different types of recreation can take place, where off-road vehicles can happen, how they're going to manage for endangered species under their jurisdiction, and things like that. And so that when individual project proposals come up, the BLM can consult its resource management plan and decide whether or not that proposal should be allowed in the area that it's proposed for.
And what about lands with wilderness characteristics?
Yeah, so that's a new thing that we've been very involved in. In 2012, Bob Abbey, who was the head of the BLM before he retired, issued two new manuals to the Bureau of Land Management, reiterating their obligation to do a complete inventory for lands with wilderness characteristics in their lands during the resource management plan process. So they are all required to go out and look at all the land they have to determine, according to criteria that they have internally, whether they have lands that have wilderness characteristics. And then in the resource management planning process, they need to consider whether or not they want to manage those areas to protect those values. So that's something that is currently happening in resource management plans all over the country. So this current management plan, it's for about, I think it's 3.4 million acres of surface land. It might be 2.8. Somehow both of those numbers are stuck in my head, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
So this plan covers all of Sierra County, so the Sierra de las Uvas, and then down into the Robledos, and then into the Las Cruces area, the Oregon Mountains, the whole proposed monument that we have going down in the south, and then over to the east, over to Otero Mesa and the Brokoff Mountains. So it's a pretty large, of BLM land.
How'd we make out in the plan and in the draft alternatives? Were there some good things, bad things?
There were some good things, but I would say largely it needs some work. this is a long history of a plan that has been, it usually takes them about 3 to 4 years. This one's been going on for, I want to say, about 10. Is that right, Nathan?
It's about close to a decade now already.
Right. So it's been sort of a long, involved process with a lot of legal challenges and other kinds of things happening. So one of the things we're very concerned about is that the BLM decided to postpone its analysis of oil and gas development in the planning area to a later date. So in this current plan, they don't analyze where they're going to lease oil and gas and where they're not. The reason that we think that's a problem is that it's very hard to do a complete analysis of how your different resources interact with each other so that you can plan smartly for the future if you don't know where oil and gas might be leased. So in other words, it's very hard to like call something a camping site if you don't know whether that piece of land might be open later to oil and gas.
Right.
And so
slightly
we thought
backwards.
That was a problem and that they, I'm sorry?
Oh, I just said that sounds slightly backwards to operate that way.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of a resource management plan is to look at all the various resources that you have, look at how those resources interact with each other, and look at what impacts might occur if you make different planning decisions in different places. And so without looking at something as large as oil and gas development, it's very hard to feel confident that they could successfully analyze the other potential uses and their impacts. So we have been urging them to do what's called a supplemental EIS, to sort of pause this RMP process, even though it means that the process will take even longer, so that they can roll the oil and gas analysis into the current plan. And we're having a similar issue with the lands with wilderness characteristics. They did a partial inventory for lands with wilderness characteristics, but in that whole 3.4 or 2.8 million surface acres, they only said that they found about 11,000 acres of lands with wilderness characteristics and only advocated for protecting about 800 of those as wilderness areas.
That's egregious.
It's egregious. And in later conversations with them, they have noted that they actually did not finish their lands with wilderness characteristics inventory, that that's still in process. And so that's something that really should have been done before the resource management plan was issued in a draft form. So we're sort of advocating for them to pause the process to finish that wilderness inventory because the same kind of problem exists. I mean,
right.
You don't know which lands have wilderness characteristics in your planning area. How can you know where to allow off-highway vehicles? Because you don't want to allow off-highway vehicles in places that have pristine wilderness characteristics. So they're sitting there making off-highway vehicle designations in this plan without knowing where wilderness characteristics may exist. So those are kind of the two largest issues that we have with this plan. There are some good things in the plan. They are proposing to designate a fairly large area of critical environmental concern for the Otero Mesa grasslands. The Coalition for Otero Mesa, which is a group of nonprofit organizations, including the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, proposed about a 600,000-acre area of critical environmental concern during the initial process of this resource management plan, and they're proposing about a 200,000-acre parcel, which is still an extremely large ACEP. So we're supporting that designation. We are trying to make the management prescriptions, which are the things they will do to keep the area of critical environmental concerns values a little bit stronger in the plan than they have been. But it's great that we could have an ACEP for the grasslands. They're not considering oil and gas development. that kind of needs to happen for the Otero Mesa area in order for us to feel good about the ACEP designation and know that it's not going to be later.
We are talking with Judy Kalman, the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. This is Earth Matters on the Hilo Members Community Radio Show. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Hilo Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm your host for today's show. I'm Nathan Newcomer, the Hilo Grassroots Organizer with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And with us today, we have Judy Kalman, our staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance based in Albuquerque. Thanks for joining us today, Judy.
Thanks, Nathan.
So we just finished up talking about the Tri-County Resource Management Plan that the Las Cruces Field Office of the Bureau of Land Management has released, which covers Doniana County, Sierra County, and Otero County, of which we have several areas of concern to our organization and to lots of outdoor recreationists that include the Oregon Mountains, Sierra de las Uvas, the Robledos, and of course Otero Mesa. And the draft document now, Judy, is closed for public comment. Is that correct?
It is correct, although the BLM does take public comments after its official comment deadline is over. So even though it did end last Friday, October 12th, I would still encourage people, if they're interested, to submit comments if they want to.
I'm kind of curious, with the government shutdown, does that somehow prolong the comment period, or does the comment period deadline still solid as a rock.
I wondered the same thing, Nathan, because we were scrambling to get our comments in. The Otero Mesa Coalition submitted about 27 pages of comments on this resource management plan, and that's in addition to a lot of previous letters that we sort of incorporated into our comments. So we submitted probably altogether like 100 pages to the BLM, and we were wondering as well whether the comment deadline got extended. As far as I know at this moment, it has not been extended further because of the shutdown. However, I did speak to Jesse Jewin, the state director of the BLM, during the shutdown to ask him that question, and he told me that as of then, which was about 3 days into the shutdown, they were not extending any comment periods, but that if the shutdown did go on for a long time, that they would consider it. So as far as I know, they haven't extended it yet, but because the shutdown was so long and they just got back to the office today, it's possible that they'll announce an extension. We did get our comments in on October 12th just to be safe, but like I said, even if they don't extend it formally, the BLM always accepts comments after the formal deadline.
So yeah, irregardless, the public should still, if they have an interest in any lands within those three counties, should definitely send in their letter.
Yeah, and you know, the BLM is required by the National Environmental Policy Act to consider and respond to all substantive comments. So
tell us a little bit about
required
that.
To respond.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about substantive comments, because sometimes people will read these documents and be like, I hate this, this is terrible, or I love this, this
right.
is wonderful. That doesn't really help the BLM guide themselves in terms of how they're going to actually manage the land. So give us an example of what would be a substantive comment.
Well, so the easiest example that I can think of is that the resource management plan, along with most other environmental impact statements, is divided up into four alternatives. The National Environmental Policy Act requires federal agencies to consider all reasonable alternatives to a proposed action. So the way that they do these RMPs is they have alternative A, B, C, and D. One is sort of just continuing the old plan. One is sort of an environmentally extra-friendly plan. One is an industry-friendly plan, and the last one is always a compromise between the two that's generally the preferred action of the agency. And so a non-substantive comment by the public would be simply saying, I want alternative B. Like, just that sentence, it's like a vote up or down is not considered a substantive comment. But if you say, I like alternative B because it does this, and you explain what about that alternative you like or don't like and what you would change about it, that's more of a substantive comment that they actually have to respond to. And the nice thing about this process is that this is just a draft resource management plan. They issue the draft, and then they have to consider all public comments that are substantive and respond to those comments, and then they tweak the plan a little bit to be a response to those comments and internal deliberations. And then they issue a final resource management plan. So it's really a good way for the public to actually get involved in the process of making the plan. I wouldn't say that they're going to listen to everybody exactly, but if there's a general trend in public comments, they really might change something about the plan in the final version.
And Judy, where can people send their public comments to? I'm imagining there's a BLM website or a physical address in Las Cruces.
There is a BLM website.
It's now up and running.
It's funny. So... It is now up and running. It's not the easiest URL address to read, but if people just search BLM Las Cruces District Office and go to the planning page, which is a page right on the Las Cruces homepage, they will be directed to an executive summary of this plan and some maps and things like that. And if you do want to send comments, the email address to send comments to is also on that website, but I can read it out loud. It's BLM_LCDO_comments@BLM.gov. And, you know, if people have questions about this, I'm always happy to answer questions, too, so people can email me.
Why don't you give us your email address, Judy?
Very easy. It's just judy@nmwild.org.
And how do you spell your first name, Judy?
J-U-D-Y.
J-U-D-Y@nmwild.org. Okay, so that's great. You mentioned a couple of other things about the RMP. Before we move away from that, I want to get back to those, and that was the potential for a couple of supplemental plans that could be added to the existing draft. And those two supplements, one was in regards to oil and gas leasing, and the other one was also in regards to lands with wilderness characteristics. You had mentioned that out of the entire field office, or actually those three counties, rather, the BLM only found 11,000 acres of potential wilderness and are only recommending 800 acres to be actually designated as such, as lands with wilderness characteristics. Now,
correct.
Now, I know from my days of doing field work on BLM lands, just in Otero Mesa, for example, there's, you know, close to 600,000 acres of, actually it's 500,000, close to 500,000 acres of land that has wilderness characteristics. How is the BLM getting off by saying that there's only potentially only 11,000 acres of wilderness in the entire three-county plan?
They're not going to. I think, I don't know exactly what they were thinking, but they haven't actually finished their inventory, and they're now acknowledging that their inventory is not complete. So that's a really good first step, because in the draft Tri-County RMP, they said that they inventoried all the land under their jurisdiction, and that was the only amount of acreage that they found.
Yeah, back in 1979.
Right. So they were using a 1979 inventory, which they're not allowed to do. They're required to update and maintain their inventory. I will say two things just to clarify about this lands with wilderness characteristics inventory thing. One is that it's not a formal designation of wilderness. The BLM is not allowed to do that by itself. Only Congress can do that. So what this is more of a preservation of those wilderness characteristics in case they ever do want to be designated as wilderness by Congress. So it's not that they would be wilderness like the Gila Wilderness. It would be that there would be lands under the BLM's jurisdiction that they would be protecting from harm in order that those wilderness characteristics are maintained.
So is it similar to like what a wilderness study area is, or is it slightly different?
It's similar to it, but they don't, you know, in wilderness areas and wilderness study areas, there are certain things you can and can't do, and those prescriptions aren't exactly as set in stone in a lands with wilderness characteristics area. It just means, really, that the BLM wouldn't permit projects that would damage those wilderness values. It doesn't necessarily mean that you couldn't ride a bike through it or a mechanized vehicle or something. It just means that they would keep the overall character of that land to be wilderness quality.
So you're pretty
confident. So it's not as strict.
So are you pretty confident that the BLM is going to go back out and finish their inventory and actually offer up some decent acreage numbers besides 11,000?
We sure hope so. Well, it's interesting because of the 11,000, 10,000 of those acres approximately were in one area outside of Las Cruces. And so they were saying that they didn't find any wilderness quality lands in Otero Mesa at all or in the entirety of Sierra County. So it's a little bit hard to believe. There are specific characteristics that are required in order for a land to be considered a land with wilderness characteristics. So it has to be a unit of at least 5,000 robust acres, and then there are a couple other things that have to qualify. So I don't, you know, not all of Otero Mesa qualifies just because there are some roads through it that make smaller units than 5,000 acres, but the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance undertook a new inventory of its own this year, inventorying this tri-county area for wilderness characteristics according to the BLM manual. And we're not even quite done. We're almost done with the three counties, but we've already submitted data for about 400,000 acres of wilderness characteristics land, according to their manual,
right,
so to the Las Cruces office.
Can you tell us a little bit about that process, like how we went and conducted that work and how we gave the data to the agency?
Yeah, definitely. So we have a really great map person, Lynn Uring, who does all of our GIS work, and she was able to look at the satellite data available through the U.S. Census Bureau, which is what all the maps come from for the federal government and for private state agencies. Everybody uses those maps. And so she was able to look at the road data for known roads on public land, and we were able to create a number of units that we knew from that map data to be more than 5,000 roadless acres. And then we actually had a field team and volunteers go out with handheld little GPS data collection units. And they went out to each of those units and surveyed for the other criteria in the BLM manual, which are naturalness. So the area has to be generally natural, which means that it's not overly impacted by human use. And then it also has to offer outstanding opportunities for primitive recreation or solitude, which is a little bit nebulous, but that's what it is anyway. So we actually were able to take pictures of those criteria. We could take a picture out in the field of a human impact and document it on a map on that unit and say, there is a stock tank for ranching right here. And so we collected that data. We looked at the maps and the photos that came with each unit. We altered our boundaries when we found roads that, you know, weren't on the satellite data, or where we didn't find roads that were on the satellite data. And we created sort of a data package for each of those units that were more than 5,000 acres. And so to the BLM, we've submitted a narrative sort of outlining why that unit qualifies under their manual. And then we've included all the pictures that were taken on that unit and all the maps. So it was a pretty in-depth process that took about
extensive.
A year and a half.
Yeah.
Like I said, we're not actually finished. There were a couple of units in Doñana County that had been washed out and inaccessible due to some flooding and heavy rains this summer. So we're still waiting for a few places to get dried out, and we might go to a couple additional areas that we think might have characteristics. But we did a lot.
Yeah, 400,000 acres of potential wilderness versus 11,000. I'll take the 400,000 any day of the week. We are talking with Judy Kalman, the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and we'll be right back after a quick break. Welcome back to the Gila Membres Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm your host for today's show. I'm Nathan Newcomer, the Gila Grassroots Organizer with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And with us today, calling in from Albuquerque, we have the staff attorney of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, Judy Kalman. Welcome back, Judy.
Thanks for having me, Nathan.
It's a pleasure. Good to have you. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the McKittrick policy and how erroneous that whole issue is. And then we've talked a little bit also about the Tri-County Resource Management Plan for the BLM Las Cruces District Office. And the next issue I wanted to ask you about, Judy, was the statewide pit rule. This is an issue that probably most New Mexicans have been following. It's an issue that has to deal with oil and gas and where they can actually have open pond waste pits where they throw in toxic sludge and all kinds of nasty goo on the drill site. Well, those pits were banned back in the Richardson administration, and then we had a change of heart once Susana Martinez came in. So tell us a little bit about that, Judy, if you can, and what's currently happening with a court date that I believe is coming up next month.
Sure. So just a little bit of history about it. A pit is officially called a wastewater disposal pit, and those occur usually after fracturing operations. Everybody's been following fracking things lately with oil and gas, but what that actually means is that when an oil or gas well is being drilled, what they do is they shoot fresh water and a bunch of chemicals down into the ground, and that sort of, the pressure breaks up a lot of the rocks and levels and stuff like that, so that there can be a larger pool of oil or gas that can be then sucked up through the well pump. But what happens is that all that fresh water and toxic chemicals get shot down, and then it actually gets pumped back up before the oil and gas comes up. And so that sort of toxic, watery mess historically was just placed in holes in the ground next to oil and gas wells where the water would evaporate, and then the sludgy, goopy stuff that you talked about that was left over after evaporation would just be buried. And so all of that stuff ended up leaching into groundwater, and it was a terrible thing. And so gradually those pits have been more and more regulated, and what occurred during the Richardson administration was that in certain areas of the state, including Otero Mesa, those kinds of pits were entirely banned, and a process called a closed-loop system would have to be used instead, where that toxic wastewater would actually be trucked off-site. But they also developed what's called the statewide pit rule, which was basically just regulations on how those pits could happen.
Before you get into that, you said there's a couple of specific areas that these pits were just outright banned. Were those like reasonable areas, or were they sort of like...
Yeah, it was all of Otero and Sierra County, more or less, except for a couple tiny areas. And so that was done under the Richardson administration specifically to protect Otero Mesa's groundwater.
There's the statewide pit rule that you also were talking about. How is that different from the doTERRA makes a sort of specific pit rule.
So the statewide pit rule, which was made under the Richardson administration, was not an outright ban on pits. Pits are only banned in those two areas, as I mentioned. But in all the rest of the state, pits are still allowed to be used, but they became much more regulated. So they were required to be lined with pretty thick plastic liners to prevent any of the leaching of those toxic chemicals into the groundwater. And then there were also a lot of what are called setbacks, which are maximum distance that a pit could be to a sensitive place like a wetland or a school or a house. So it required that pits could not be located, you know, several hundred feet into those things. And it also required that pits had to be a certain distance away from known groundwater deposits. So, in other words, you couldn't bury those wastewater disposal chemicals when, you know, if you dug 2 feet deeper, you'd hit a groundwater deposit.
Seems pretty reasonable to me.
Too shallow. Right. They were reasonable. You know, if you have to have these wastewater disposal pits, you know, better to keep them away from wetlands and schools and houses and groundwater, and better to keep them lined with pretty thick plastic liners. And, you know, of course, it's always better to do what's called a closed-loop system because then you're not leaving anything in the ground. But the Richardson pit rule just kind of regulated some of that stuff.
So what's the problem here? Why is Susana Martinez not wanting us to protect our groundwater resources?
Do you want the political answer?
Tell me the truth, Judy. Give us the truth.
Well, the oil and gas industry has been very supportive of her elections, and in turn, she has been very supportive of the oil and gas industry, and I think that's the kindest way to say it. And so shortly after her election to governor in 2010, the industry represented by the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, as well as the Independent Petroleum Association of New Mexico, petitioned the Oil Conservation Commission, who is an administrative body charged with regulating oil and gas. Two out of three of those members are appointed directly by the governor. So she was able to get a majority of her appointees on that commission. And they petitioned her commission to basically rescind the pit rule. Initially, they asked for a reversal of the Otero Mesa pit rule as well, but that was later dropped. But they asked or revisions to the regulation part of the pit rule that took away a lot of those setbacks, minimized, you know, it made the depth to groundwater requirement a lot shallower. It shortened the length of space that could be between a pit and a school, between a pit and a wetland. So now instead of things like 300 feet, it's like 25 feet. The individual requirements for each type of thing vary, but it's that much of a difference. The only thing that they did not touch was the lining requirement, because I guess that sounds crazy to get rid of the lining requirement for the pits. So anyway,
I could have sworn that after the pit rule was implemented, that the industry itself, the oil and gas industry itself, they just went ahead and did all these new things. And it was sort of like,
oh yeah,
the new thing.
No.
And
they
so they
totally
were fine
did
with
all
it.
These things, and they are fine with it. It doesn't cost them that much more money. Closed-loop systems are actually becoming the industry standard nationwide. So a lot of the larger oil and gas companies are voluntarily switching to closed-loop systems anyway. I think what this is some of the smaller companies that aren't necessarily, they don't have as much of a margin in their profits. You know, it's cheaper to bury your stuff on the site, and it's cheaper to do it right where you are instead of having to move it 300 feet away from a school or whatever.
Who cares about our groundwater?
It seems to me, right. And so after a very long series of hearings last year, the commission did exactly what the oil and gas industry wanted them to. So it basically
Surprise.
Revised the pit rule in such a way that it is now much less meaningful, to say the least. And so those of us who were a party to those administrative hearings, mostly led by the New Mexico Environmental Law Center and the Oil and Gas Accountability Project, decided to appeal the commission's ruling to the state courts. And so we have our first hearing about that on November 4th. You know, it just seems really crazy and only based on political motivations that this rule was overturned. And the thing that stands out about these hearings is that none of the evidence that was heard at these hearings as a reason for changing the rule was different than the evidence that was heard in the initial hearings for creating the rule in the first place.
Right. And so, and in the first first round of hearings, there was a lot of evidence that actually pointed to groundwater contamination because of leaking
right.
ponds. And it's just like, okay, I think there were like 800
cases.
Yeah,
the state has
cases.
Documentation. Amazingly, the state has documentation of a lot of groundwater contamination that have been found from oil and gas operations. And so during the last hearing, the state was actually advocating for these rules, which was only 6 years ago, the last rule, 6 or 7 years ago. So it wasn't that long ago. So all of the evidence was the same about, you know, how toxins travel through soil and how toxins travel through water and things like that. None of that is any different. And they all acknowledged during this set of hearings that none of that had changed. And so they didn't really have a reason for wanting to change the rule other than political things and economics. So they were trying to say that it was cheaper for them to do it in this less safe way. However, the commission is actually barred from considering economic reasons when regulating groundwater and oil and gas. So the only real reason that they had was actually not something that the commission was allowed to consider. And in this round of hearings, the state was actually, kind of not advocating for safer rules because it's a different administration. So it was very interesting and very depressing.
So with the court case that's happening, the court date, I said, or rather, on November 4th, what's going to happen there? And are you going to be participating in that?
We are participating in that. New Mexico Wilderness Alliance joined the New Mexico Environmental Law Center in its appeal. I'm not doing a lot of the work because it's not my lead. Eric Jantz from the New Mexico Environmental Law Center has taken the lead on this, and he's awesome and doing an amazing job. So I will be going for moral support, and I don't really know what's going to happen. It's really interesting.
Well, are there good? Is it just
to update you guys later?
Is this just the beginning of the court process?
Yeah, this is our first hearing.
So, any witnesses?
Not at this.
Okay. So I'm trying to figure out though what the grounds are for the court case. Like what are we actually going to court saying, okay, you can't legally do this?
So there's a legal standard called arbitrary and capricious.
Right.
Which basically means that an agency just did something for no justifiable reason. Agencies, both state and federal, are given a lot of discretion with the decisions that they make, and as long as they have some reasonable justification for their decision, they're generally upheld by courts. However, they're not allowed to do something arbitrary and capricious, which means that they either ignored scientific data, ignored obvious evidence, made a decision based on a whim, you know, reversed themselves based on no justification, that kind of thing. So that's the standard that we're arguing, that, you know, they heard the same evidence this time as they heard last time and completely reversed the rule based on nothing other than what appears to be politics. So that would qualify as arbitrary and capricious.
Well, it sounds like we have a pretty good argument to make in this case then.
You would think so, that's the whole excitement of the legal system is you never know what's going to happen. So.
Well, that's why we have you as our staff attorney to help us guide us through those muddy waters, as it will be.
I will try.
Judy, we've got about less than 2 minutes to go in the show. Is there anything else that you'd like us to touch on before we sign off?
I don't think so. Those were the major things. It's been a very good review of all the projects I'm working on. I think I made notes to myself of things I have to look into after having this interview. So, I hope people get more involved. And again, if people have questions for me, I'm always happy to answer them if that's helpful. So judy@nmwild.org.
Yeah. And say your email address again, Judy?
judy@nmwild.org.
And do you want to throw out a phone number?
Sure. It's 505-843-8696, extension 102.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in today. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I miss working alongside you up in Albuquerque, but this will just have to do.
Me too.
You've been listening to the Gila Membres Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. I'm your host, Nathan Newcomer, and we're signing off for now. Until next time, take care.